This is Father Gregory Pine.
And this is Father Jacob Bertrand Jancic.
And welcome to God's Planning. Thanks to all those who support us. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider making a monthly donation on Patreon. Be sure to like and subscribe to God's Planning wherever you listen to your podcasts. Father Jacob Bertrand.
Hey.
Hey, we're doing a special episode.
Yeah, we're in an atrium.
We're in an atrium.
It's kind of cool.
Right? Yeah. So those of you who are listening will notice that the audio quality is somewhat different. It seems more spacious. Those of you who are watching will notice that the video quality is somewhat different because we are overlooking the beautiful bluffs of the Missouri.
And it's better.
And it's better, yeah.
So
those of you who are neither listening nor watching will notice nothing because that's how sensation works. So we're very delighted to be here at U Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota, at the very generous invitation of Father Dominic Bauck. So your impressions so far? We've been here for almost 24 hours. Bismarck, for or against?
It's tough. I won't say for or against. I will say disappointed. And because I was so I'm coming from New Hampshire, and it's cold in New Hampshire, but I think it's colder in New Hampshire now than it is here. I was expecting like 40s, negative, whatever. And I get off the plane, I was like, I brought two jackets. And now I feel like...
and a pair of boots.
Yeah, and a boot and boots. I was like, I was ready to go. So far, other than that, it's good. It's good.
other than the fact that it's not negative 15, it's been a very pleasant visit.
Yeah.
So if you come to the end of your life and the only thing that people will complain about you is that you're not negative 15 degrees, you've lived well. So congratulations, Bismarck. Congratulations, all of you here. So before pushing play, we asked for some suggestions as to a theme that we could entertain for the podcast itself. And this being a college campus, you know, similar questions are being asked on college campuses the world over. I suspect that those questions have a peculiar expression here in North Dakota, since we're at a very Catholic school, which seems to be in many ways of one mind and one heart. But questions are specific, like what's the point? You know, like why are we here at school? And then how does that inform the discernment of our vocations? So whether to priesthood or religious life or to marriage, and concretely speaking with respect to marriage, dating, at what point do you begin? Like 12, 17, 24, never, etc. Okay. Do we just skip the dating and go straight to arranged marriages? Father Jacob Bertrand, that's his preference for others.
there needs to be a lot of clarification.
I'm just throwing bombs and hoping that you'll defuse them all. So where do you think is a good place to begin this conversation?
When we think about things of life, right? Because all of that lumps under the like life thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. You know, very descriptive, really good.
Yeah.
that it's a question of, well, one, we first have to assess what the end is, like what are we after? You know, so what's the point of thinking about school, about friendships, about dating, about like work after school, that sort of thing, if we aren't considering what is that aimed at? What are we chasing after? Because then like the intermediary steps, if the end isn't worked out, doesn't it's like kind of like who cares? And that for me in my mind and thought falls under like just the category. I don't know. I was going to say discernment and prudence, but I was, for those who don't know, whether you're here or listening, I served as our vocation director for 4 years, and I really dislike the word discernment, but that's like a whole nother, it's fine. It's an okay word, but that falls under the word of, we could talk about choices.
Let's do that.
Prudence.
Yeah. Oh, I like that.
Sometimes discernment.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
And thinking about all of that, that's where my thoughts go right away is like, how do we begin to choose well in our lives with respect to all that, but most especially with respect to our final end, with respect to choosing God. So if we aren't asking the questions of school, work, life, friends, dating, family, whatever it might be, if that end of how does that relate and how does that move me closer to God isn't there, and that doesn't have to be like a scrupulous thing where it's like, oh my gosh, like I'm going on one date, is this getting me closer? It doesn't matter, whatever, but go on the date. But if that's not the kind of what like influencing motif of all of that, then it's kind of like for naught, I think.
Yeah, no, that's a great place to start. So the first in intention is the last in execution. The first thing that you have in mind is a goal for yourself. And all of us have some vague sense of, you know, I want to be happy, but we want that happiness to be more concrete, more actionable in our lives. So some people are like, I'm going to amass riches and swim through them like Scrooge McDuck. Or other people are like, I'm going to get them to like me. And that's one way of living your life as well. Or other people are like, I'm going to experience every imaginable sense pleasure. And I've already booked my tickets for Jakarta. But then those who, you know, find themselves at a place like Umeri are probably thinking, at least entertaining the possibility of having God for their last end. Because at the end of the day, he is your last end. It's just a matter of whether or not you'll admit it and then shape your life accordingly. So to have that between our navigational beacons and then to then approach all these intermediate ends of life or these kind of means, we could describe them as, from the vantage or from the perspective that this either is to connect or it's to distract from, disperse from, or otherwise interrupt from that pursuit is helpful. And it might not be the type of thing where you can do the kind of happiness calculus in a straightforward way. Like, should I brush my teeth this morning or should I not brush this teeth more? Like, okay, there's a small chance that if I brush my teeth this morning, I could choke on the toothpaste and then I would convert, you know, 1,700 fewer people over the course of my life on account of the fact that I'm dead. And so maybe I should, it's like, easy there, chief, just brush your teeth, you know?
Yeah.
Right, so it's good for us to think, all right, the ultimate end and then these intermediate ends. And in speaking of these intermediate ends, now we're talking about, you know, raising a family and getting a job and making enough money to pay back college loans. Those are all part of the conversation. So then in your conversation with students when you worked at Dartmouth, in your conversation with people discerning a vocation as they came to the order, I mean, in your conversation with everyone else, how do you begin the work of arranging those ends or prioritizing those ends?
Yeah, a pitfall that I think we fall into is that we look at these different parts of our lives or these different components of our lives and give them more weight than they actually deserve, you know, this sort of thing. So like a question of dating, like when to start dating, how to start, like it almost like in a sense, it's kind of like, who cares? Mm. Kind of like just go date if you want or don't, if you don't want.
What if I'm seven?
Okay, well... Who cares? No, just kidding. Just kidding. But for me, it's less of a sort of what I think is important is less of a sort of like continual existential kind of assessment of what I'm doing, and much more important. What's much more important is being able to recognize how it is that the Lord is equipping us to make good decisions, right? Because the whole point, as you were laying out, the whole point of our sort of knowing the end and then assessing the means and moving towards that, whether it's the whole host of options that we mentioned, the whole point there is that in living with Christ, in living with God, he gives us the grace not for us to become some sort of understander of like a fortune teller. Like God isn't a fortune teller. The prayer isn't about like looking into the crystal ball to just sort of divine God's will. So that way then we could be told what to do. It's different than that. God gives us grace so that we might be more truly and fully human. And that includes being decision makers, like making good, prudent decisions in accord with what is good for me in my state of life, but also looking forward to what might come. And all of that looking forward to him. So like the sort of place for where I think it's important for us to start and to focus is on that. It's like, what is God doing in my life and for me? And that's to make me more truly human so that I can be entrusted with that sort of humanity to make choices, make decisions, be prudent, be charitable, be, you know, live the theological virtues and then live a life in accord with that. And then I think, I'm not trying to be like a quietist on the life decisions, like it'll just happen. No, you have to act, you have to cooperate. But once life is kind of organized and situated in that way, the rest of sort of the decision-making, that's where I can kind of say, making a joke, like it doesn't matter. Well, it matters, but it matters only in as much as it's related to the rest, and that like it kind of sits within that network, that nexus of right living, I guess.
Yeah, let's then we can think about that under three headings. So God, community, and self. With respect to God, I think that theology ends up being hyper practical in these matters. Sometimes we think about theology is a study that's conducted in an ivory tower that doesn't really inform our everyday life. But there are certain theological truths without which we just can't get along. So for instance, that God created you not because he needs you, but because he blesses you, that's huge. Because I think a lot of us are seized by a kind of dread fear that we're going to get it wrong We need to continually return to the fact, the awesome fact, that God doesn't lay snares. He doesn't set traps, right? God provides a way forward. He blazes that trail. And that's not to say like prosperity gospel, like you're going to get a humpback whale and a new car and a full bank account. But it does mean that God has created you for a purpose, that that purpose is good, that you're capable of understanding that purpose in some way, shape, or form, and of embracing that. So you can, in a certain sense, set aside the principal obstacle to the living of your vocation, which is anxiously or anguishedly thinking about your vocation as if it were not from God, who is good, who provides a way. Second thing is with the community. A lot of times we think it's our responsibility to think through everything in life. It is not our responsibility to think through everything in life. We are rational, undoubtedly, but we're also rational animals. Animals move in packs. They do things instinctually. They learn from their parents and they just lather, rinse, repeat. I think it's entirely appropriate as human beings to do a good bit of that. Like our freedom isn't so much like I have option A and I have option B and I have made an Excel macro which compares them in every imaginable way and I've run that 17 times so as to account for potential error. And now with the certainty that this is clearly better for X, Y, and Z reasons, I will pursue that course. It's just inhuman, right? It's robotic. I mean, as AI advances, there's less and less need for us to do anything like that. We can just do the human stuff, which fortunately is a lot more fun. So we can trust that the human community bears a kind of corporate reason and that it's for us to like ratify that rather than invent it. So what are they out there doing? All right, maybe we just do that. We don't have to be constantly critical of the culture, especially if the culture is infused with gospel principles, which it seems like the university is. So you can trust that if it were Crazy Town USA, population 1300, that you'd get a little bit of that Crazy Town vibe and you'd be like, maybe I should distance myself and go to NDSU. I hear they have a great Newman Center. Right. So like, but you can kind of trust what people are doing to a certain degree or extent. And then the third thing is, you know, yourself, which is to say prudence. God's placed your life in your hands. Some of you were at the Cardinal O'Connor conference in Georgetown this past Saturday. And it's just like a big thing that I like to emphasize. Again, God's placed your life in your hands because he wants to see what you'll make of it. Because our human freedom is expressed in a kind of creativity. It's expressed in a kind of virtuosity. And we can trust that even if it is limited, even if it has certain weaknesses or bears certain wounds, that it's going to be beautiful. It's going to be wonderful insofar as God has given us the grace to live it as such. So I think that it can be helpful to kind of organize our thoughts there under the rubrics of God, community, and you know, self and personal prudence. I don't know if there's a particular one of those headings where you want to drill down or a particular thing that you want to follow up on.
Yeah, I think the self, as you were describing all of those, the self, what are they, categories?
Headings.
The self heading is one that's interesting to me because when we begin to think then about like, what would we say, like practical application with regard to these questions of like, I don't know, dating, friendship, that sort of thing. The reality of that is that we have to sort of be the question of like, well, how do I do that well? There, I think there has to be an initial like self-possession, right? Of like self-confidence in who we are as sons and daughters of God and what we're after. You know, so it's like, what does that look like? Well, that looks like having a life that's well set. Not perfect. That doesn't mean things are perfect, but that like things are well set before we attempt to like give ourselves in a fuller capacity, right? So that like we have some sort of prayer life, we have like some sort of pursuit of virtue and like rooting out sin in our lives, that we have these sort of like mechanism sounds to like industrial to talk about the faith, but these kind of mechanisms in place so that when we want to engage, when we want to like dive into like a life of study or work or friendship or relationships, we have a foundation on which we rely. And of course that's God, that's that foundation, but that God allows us to be built into human beings, but that human beings who can flourish and give of ourselves, but that requires our investment, that mm-hmm. requires our cooperation with his grace and that sort of thing. So, yeah, that I think that's just super important to it's not like a self-help thing. Like if I make myself better, everything will be better. But it is a reality of like we have to prioritize our relationship with God and what he's doing in our lives in order to like move and function in any other kind of circle or whatever part of life.
Yeah. And I think we can think about our human formation. And that includes, you know, education and friendships and liturgical life. We can think about our human formation as affecting this change in our lives, because we're on a path, and that path, please God, leads to heaven. But if it's to lead to heaven, then it will require of us healing and growth. Because while there are plenty of people in the world who will tell you that, you know, you're great just the way you are, which in a certain sense you are, there is still more to be had in life, because God wills it for you. Not because he doesn't affirm that you're great, but because he wills you unto a fuller grandeur, unto a fuller human excellence. And that goes by way of addressing the wounds that have been dealt to our nature, reclaiming the graces that we have defaulted on, and then advancing in the type of sanctity which we saw in the documentary last night, born out in the life of Michelle what's her last name?
Dupong.
Thank you. I was about to say Lupong, and I was like, that's not it. So I think that like when we approach the different stages in our life, we think about them in terms of formation. And that helps us, you know, to focus, like, why would you come to the university? For what type of formation have you come? I was listening to a lecture recently, and it was about agrarian reform and the thought of Wendell Berry. And the professor gave an excellent lecture. At the end of the lecture, a student raised his hand, and he asked, like, okay, we're at this university, and then we have these institutions which are unjust for X, Y, and Z reasons. What do we do in order to advocate for the restoration of these goods to these people to whom they rightly belong? And the professor just had no patience for it. He said, if you're interested in advocacy, leave the university. And I was like, woof, bow wow. Because you don't hear that in many quarters. But I think that it helps us to focus on this precise point, like, why have you come to the university? You've come for a formation, and you've come specifically for an academic formation, you know? And that might be an academic formation more in, like, in line with a particular vocation or avocation, with a particular job, you know? So it might be more technical. It might have less to do with the liberal arts, but you still have these core classes, you know, 3 philosophy, 3 theology for which you're responsible. And I imagine other things besides which kind of engage you in the life of the mind. So you're here to be formed as an individual, as a thinking individual, as a loving individual. And I think that's important, right? And you've probably chosen this school because you know that there are other options, but they might be more lonely and sad and anxiety inducing, and the chances that you'll lose your soul at those places is probably higher because you know that you're weak and wounded, and the chances that you'll be assimilated are decent because when's the last time we stood up for everything or anything alone? It was like never. So I think that you have, you know, you have these various thoughts in mind in approaching the question of college, and it's good to sort out amongst them rather than not sorting out amongst them and then getting lost in the midst of a kind of bazaar of competing goods. So thinking specifically then about the university context, we're making our way towards dating. What are the goods on offer, and then how are we beginning to order our lives to reflect those goods?
I first want to say something different about Wendell Berry.
Yeah,
have you guys read Wendell Berry? Wendell Berry fans, one. That's honestly, that's what I expect. It's fine. Right on par. I think one summer Father Gregory and I were driving out to Colorado from DC together, to go to Focus Summer Projects, and I was driving, I remember, and we put Wendell Berry on tape.
Did we?
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And you fell asleep.
Oh, nice.
And I don't like Wendell Berry at all. So like, you're like in the middle of Kansas with nothing, with just Wendell Berry playing. And yeah, it was rough.
Yeah.
So one Wendell Berry fan, it's on par. That makes sense. Cool. Yeah. Anyways, nothing against Wendell Berry, except he's boring. It's all good though.
Yeah, yeah.
So question about the university. Yeah, what is... So, as you were saying, like it is important to recognize that, like, when we come to a place to study, it's to form the intellect, right? And that's not like a, we don't want to take that, or I don't want you listening to take that as like that's the intellect is divorced from the will and our emotions and desires and our lives. And no, they're wildly integrated. They can't be separated. But it's first and foremost to form the intellect. And why but that's incredibly important. Why? Well, because if you look at how it is that we're made as men and women, as children of God in his image, we're made with, as we well know, an intellect and a will, a mind to know and a heart to love. But we can't love that which we don't know. You know, the will, the heart follows the intellect, it follows the mind. So if I have no concept, if I have absolutely no concept of something intellectually, I can't possibly desire it. I can't possibly will it or begin to love it. And just the opposite is true, is that as we begin to come to know something more and more, the better we're able to love it. And it's this cyclical relationship. We can think of that with studies, but let me use an example that's not studies, but even with other people, with like a relationship, just a friendship, right? Like when you meet a stranger, there isn't this burning desire immediately to share your life with that person, right? There might be an interest. It's like, oh, cool person, or like maybe not, never see you again. But like if it's the cool person category, it's like you come to know more about that person and there's a desire to share and to give and that sort of thing. And that can grow and grow into a real friendship. It's the same with the intellectual life in our study, that we don't come to study, we don't come to learn, we don't come to like, there's this Dominican sort of motto or saying that the wood of the desk is the wood of the cross for the Dominican. Like we don't come to sit and study and give ourselves to that just to amass knowledge, just to have like things to say, just to have, I don't know, like to be able to regurgitate things on an exam. Like maybe sometimes that's what happens, but that's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to have, to use this capacity of intellect and reason that's been given to us by God so that we can come to know him and come to know things, the things of him, the things he's created, the world around us, ultimately so that we might in the end be better lovers, that we might love more truly, that we might love God more truly, that we may love people in our lives, that we may love the neighbor more truly. I mean, that's the ultimate goal of our study. You know, it's to what? It's to like allow these faculties, right? Our intellect and our will, our minds and our hearts to flourish. And when the university, I mean, this is like you made the critique too in that Wendell Berry story, but like when going to college and when the university becomes a place of like political advocacy and that sort of, it's like, it's missing the point. Even if it's good advocate, like it just begins, if that's the primary end, we just begin to miss the point, because what's on offer in like the flourishing of our mind and therefore what follows our heart is like, there's something bigger. We're invited into something so much more in that. And I don't know, I'm thinking back to like when I was in college and then seminary and studies, it's like, I don't know if I did a good job, but like my presentation there of mind and heart and flourishing there kind of seems like, great, that sounds awesome. But then you get into class and it's like, not awesome. Like this is terrible. But nonetheless, it's true. It's like through the practical day-to-day grind of like living in this context that like there is something great and glorious on offer in it.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, there are going to be people who are more practically minded. There are going to be people who are more speculatively minded. And there are going to be people who come to the university to get the credential, to get the job. That's nothing to be ashamed of, right? Because it's like, here we are in the 21st century. It seems like a necessary prerequisite in a lot of lines of work. So cheers to you. But if you find yourself at the university with that type of disposition, cool. You've got 2 or 3 or 4 years. You may as well give it a go. Doesn't mean that you have to change your personality, but I would say like, don't define yourself by your weaknesses. Like a lot of people are too comfortable saying, I'm not a morning person, so dot, dot, dot. Well, if I'm not a morning person, so dot, 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 means that you never actually, you know, like work on constancy or fidelity in prayer because you always push it off to the end of the day because you're groggy in the morning. Maybe that's a false self-definition. And maybe you should let like the Lord tell you who you are, what your real identity is. And it might be that you're just enough of a morning person to pray for 20 minutes each morning, right? We can leave that in his hands. He knows better. And so I think that when it comes to university, if you expect that it will be just years of drudgery and warfare, then that's probably what you'll find, right? But if you expect of it that it might broaden your horizons, it might open your mind, not so as simply to leave it open, so as to be preyed upon by ideologues and demagogues, but to open it so that it can lay hold of something, right? You open your mind for the same reason that you open your mouth, all right? Because you hope to receive, that is to say, to chew, to digest, right? And so we want to open our minds, and especially in a place like this, which we could describe in the classic sense as a safe space, where you're not going to be preyed upon by professors who want to manipulate you and associate you with their team so that way they can, what, feel good about themselves and their most recent Marxist cause? Who cares, right? You have people here who actually want to give you God. They want to give you the truth, which is a rare privilege, especially in the 21st century. And so it just takes a little bit of docility to say, all right, Lord, I stink at this stuff, but you made me, and here I am at the university, seems somewhat unavoidable, so grant me the grace to desire it. I think that's a decent enough place to start. But if you're more speculatively minded, well, then this is your playground. But it's not just a four-year playground. It can be a lifelong playground. Because the point isn't just, like Father Jacob Burchin said, to amass knowledge. The point is to craft habits of mind and heart which suit us for a life of inquiry. There's a Dominican author who says that the intellectual is like, he's like a stagecoach rider who always has his nostrils to the wind, picking up new scents and seeing what's there, you know, for him to discover. And I think that you should always be testing your theses against reality, because it's easy to lapse into easy tropes, or it's easy to lapse into kind of like weather-worn or ready-made reactions. It's like, this person said this, so I'm going to say not this. That's not thinking, right? That's not thinking. But if you receive genuine principles upon which you can reason here and formulate arguments, then that can be thinking. And again, you don't have to be smart. The point's not to be smart. The point is to try to know and to love. And I think that the university is a great place to craft those habits, especially as you come from high school and maybe you enjoyed it, maybe you didn't enjoy it. Regardless, here we are. Let's make the best of it. And I think that that too then helps to frame, you know, our understanding of relationships, because you want to leave space for what's primary. So the ultimate end being the knowledge and love of God. And then these intermediate ends arranged within the setting of our community, given the time and place. Here we're here to study, but we're also here to grow in our life of faith and hope and charity, and to do so with an eye towards the vocation, which will help us attain to the end. It's not the end itself, though some people make of it the end itself, so which will help us attain to the end. But I think that often enough, it's the case that we fall into these types of relationships rather than actually choosing these relationships. So the emphasis on prudence helps us to think about it more in terms of choice. So let's turn there. Let's think about choosing dating rather than lapsing into dating, falling into dating, sliding into dating, coasting into dating, whatever else into dating. Your thoughts, where are we going to begin this part?
Arranged into dating? Just kidding. I don't think I've ever advocated for arranged marriage in my life. I don't know why you said that, but you know, we're going to run with
just
it.
Just yesterday.
Yeah. When I arranged, no, just kidding. So I think a great spot A great spot to start and thinking about, like, do I want to date or do I not want to date? Is it like a timing thing or is it like a life thing? I keep hitting this mic. Or is it like a life thing? You know, because like priesthood, religious life, something like that, is to begin to look at desires. Like, what do you want? What's on your heart? Like, what do you see yourself doing? What do you see? Do you see yourself as like a mother with children? Well, if you don't know that, then you can't be a religious sister. Like that those two, you can't be a mom and a religious sister, you know, kind of thing. Or like, do you see yourself as a husband and father? Like, then that's not the priesthood. And that's not to say that you have to have that answer worked out in the beginning, but it's a good place to start, because like Father Gregory said, like, the Lord is not laying snares. He's not trying to be coy. He wants to purify our desires, but in doing so, he also gives us the desires to our desires to help like indicate like, what is my heart after? What am I made for? And those sort of things. So in like the choice world, the choice department, I think it's really helpful to start there. Because if you're totally not attracted to, I'll use this example. When I was in college, I went to college about a little bit north of New York City. And the CFR's sisters would come up to campus a good bit. And they were really my first exposure to religious life. And then I got to know the CFR friars, just very brief. Like, I never went on a vocation visit, but I thought that was my first exposure to religious life. And I thought like, maybe Franciscans. And then I realized this sounds awful. I'm going to say this and it's being recorded. I have no desire to serve the poor. I love the poor, you know, but like to live a life in service to the poor was not something that I felt drawn to and that sort of thing, you know? So it was like, probably not the Franciscans, cross them off. And then years later, my parents were visiting me in DC, and we were in the Basilica across the street, the National Basilica. And there were some CFRs walking around. And I said to my mom, I was like, hey, that was the other religious community I considered for about 34 seconds. And my mom saw them, you know, just like their tunic and like unshaven. And she was like, that would have never worked. She like knew it, like not a chance. She was right. So, but it's this idea of desire, of choice, that then we can apply prudence to, decision-making to. And again, it doesn't have to be, it's not a complicated thing. We ought not overcomplicate it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So I think maybe start there or pick up there with desire. I think it's good to know, like, right, when it comes to dating, we're talking about one of the most instinctual desires in the human person, right? So the most instinctual would be food and drink, because you need to eat and to drink in order to ensure that you're here tomorrow or next week. You know, it doesn't happen that soon, I suppose. And then when it comes to sexual intercourse, the desire is so instinctual because it ensures that the species will be there in 40 years, in 80 years, in 120 years. So this is hardwired into us at the level of nature. It doesn't even enter as a conscious thought, except downstream of the fact that it enters into us at the level of nature. And then given the fact that we've fallen, right, we experience these most instinctual desires as most I don't know if tortured is the right word, but most tinged or most affected by that fall. That's not to say they're bad. It's not to say they're evil. It's not to say they're irredeemable. It's not to say that marriage is a concession to the flesh. It's not to say a bunch of things. What is it to say? It's just to say we need to know that we're weak and we need to know that we're wounded because we can't be naive about that fact or we will prove ourselves foolish. All right, so given all that, given the fact that our desires kind of come from an instinctual place, but can mature into a kind of graced place, we need to be solicitous for that transformation. We need to be motivated by that transformation. And so that means on the one hand, we need to be somewhat critical of our desires. We can't just say, I want this thing, and so I'm gonna get this thing, all right? On the other hand, we need to be patient with our desires. We need to give them the space to heal and to grow. That is to say, to mature into their fullness. So often, like when people pose the question, Father Gregor, what should I do with my life? Which no one asked me, by the way. But if they were to ask me, I would say this. What should I do with my life? I'd say, well, are you praying? You know, are you making good use of the sacraments? Are you engaging in Christian friendships? Are you introducing some penance into your life? Are you studying the faith? Are you serving the material poor in some way, shape, or form? And if the person would say, yes, 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 I'd be like, cool, 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 cool. And I would say, next, how long? And if they were like 5 seconds, I'd be like, well, keep doing that. And then we can circle back in a few months. And if the person was like, you know, 2 years, 3 years, I'd be like, cool, cool, cool. All right, well, what do you want to do with your life? What do you want to do for a vocation? And if the person would be like, get married, then I would say, get married. Good talk, right? Because you can trust that if those things are present in your life, you're doing what you can to engage with them well, then God's going to heal you and grow you, and your desires become more reliable. They become more indicative.
Yeah, and that the way you just explained that sort of list of like, am I doing these things that are foundational and part and parcel of living the faith, but also like living human life well? And when that comes up against, or when the question of dating comes up, you know, as it was posed, like part of the question is like, when should I begin to do that? What you say is like, if those pieces aren't in place, then it seems to be like probably not the best time, because what is the point of dating? Well, not every dating relationship is going to end in marriage. Only one of them is going to end in marriage. And like the point though of marriage is to be, of dating is to be prepared so as to give yourself totally and completely in that bond of matrimony to another person. So dating doesn't mean we're there yet, but it means that we're in process, you know, like you're working on it. And if on the one hand, if those things aren't in place, prayer, sacramental life, study, you know, like the things that you listed, then it seems like we're not ready to begin even practicing giving ourselves to somebody else, because we're not even giving ourselves to the Lord in these basic ways. But I don't think that all, and I'm not saying that this is what you're saying, it doesn't all need to be perfected and worked out, because we're always in a school of conversion. We're always in a school of deepening. And so it's like, are things set in such a way that like, I can kind of enter into this relationship. And if like, you know, if things are in order in that kind of way, it's like, well, take a little time to work on you, let the Lord work on you before you bring somebody else in. But again, like, and as you're saying, and as I'm saying, that doesn't mean like we have to have I need to be a saint before I can date. It's like, here's hoping like you're never going to date in your life then. And maybe on the other side of heaven, but you know, kind of thing. So,
yeah. Yeah. And I think at this point we can kind of get in some practicals too. So we're thinking about the ultimate end being God, right? And our knowledge and love of God. And then we're thinking about the various intermediate ends, which arrange themselves along the course of our lives here. You know, our study, our formation is, you know, it attains to a certain importance, and we should honor that. We should respect that. But dating, you know, it's a good thing, you know, and you can be thinking about getting married. And I think that, you know, most of you will get married because that's what most people do. And I don't say that with a kind of exhalation and disappointment, like would that you could all be Dominicans. Well, if you were all Dominicans, I mean, if everyone the world over were all Dominicans within a generation, then the human race would cease to exist in short order. Because, you know, like this is the ordinary course, right? And by ordinary, I don't mean like not extraordinary. I mean ordinary as what obtains in order that God's plan be fulfilled. Because in the garden, there was just marriage. There wasn't priesthood. There wasn't religious life. Because God intended that the life of grace be communicated in the setting of the family. That when a new child would have been welcomed into that family, had they not sinned, that child would have been welcomed with a life of grace. So the family was always intended as a kind of monstrance of sanctity. And so I think that most of you are called to marriage, and you don't have to be overly conflicted about that. I'll defer to Father Bauck when it comes to the particular determination of whether you need to spend some time thinking about priesthood or religious life. But I think in most cases, like, you know, you come into a wonderful family and you acquire the savor of family life and you're inclined to it and then you pursue it. And it doesn't need to be other than that. But I think that we can be somewhat critical of our desires at points and then somewhat patient with our desires. And these kind of practical tips, which we will now turn to, can be helpful. One thing I would say is a dating fast for a year at the beginning of your university time is a move. And I think it's a good move. My sisters recommended it to me because I went to Franciscan University of Steubenville and I'd gone to public school all the way through. I was in a high school of like 2,200 kids and trying to date in a setting like that. As you know, I mean, this is like 20 years ago, so it was different, but it's worse now. It's just nigh unto impossible to try to, like, on the one hand, date, and on the other hand, not lose your soul. It's tricky. And so they're like, you're going to go to Steubenville. You're going to see all these great gals. You're going to want to date all of them simultaneously. Just cool your jets, you know, give it a year, make good friends. And that way, if you were to break up with this, you know, so-called gal, you know, like it's your junior year or something like that, then you won't look around and realize you don't have any friends because you'll have spent your first year making friends. So do that, make friends. I was like, cool. Okay, good. So I did that. And it was in the course of that first year where in just having a little bit of space, not that I was like some great dater in high school, but having a little bit of space from those desires, a little bit of like critical space from those desires, I began to entertain the possibility of priesthood and religious life. And it was just good to have that time and it matured. So I'd say a 1 year dating fast at the beginning of college, not mandatory, but you know, recommended. Cheers to that. Your thoughts?
On the 1 year dating fast took?
No. On practicals. Oh. not on my dating fast. Oh,
because I would have arranged something.
Yeah, exactly. No, yeah.
Just kidding. I think that as, a good practical, and perhaps this isn't like an immediate outset, but as like if a relationship develops or as one develops, I think there has to be a good sense of mutuality in the relationship, and one that's also a mutual sort of giving in that relationship that is appropriate to the duration of the relationship. So if you're like, hey, I'm going on a date and we're going to see what this is about, and the other person's like, here's the wedding ring, it's like, okay, there's like a disjunct here. You know, there needs to be a sort of mutual growing together. And I think you can see that pretty quickly in a relationship. But like, are we on the same page? Are we looking, and perhaps that's a better way to put it, like, are we looking for the same things? Are we on the same page about like where life is going and that sort of thing? And I don't know, like I think that's important, because if there are mismatched expectations or desires that you just run into trouble. And again, that's not like everything needs to be worked out day one, but a kind of question of like, are we in a similar place such that we can like this, the relationship can develop together organically. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah. I think it's an important factor.
Yeah, no, for sure. One more kind of practical recommendation for me is in a relationship, bring both your abundance and your lack or your need or your poverty. I think it can become a certain temptation to constantly bear your need, your lack, your poverty in the context of a relationship, kind of use the other person as a way by which to deaden the pain or to lessen the sorrow or to escape some of the boredom, the distraction, the disintegration, whatever else, right? But I think that it's more characteristic of the lover that he is a lover than that he is loved. You're like, that's the most complicated thing I've ever heard. What do I mean by that? Like if you genuinely love, that is born out by loving, all right? Now, in loving, you become in turn wonderful. You become in turn beautiful and thereby more lovable. But if you go into a relationship with the disposition, I want to be lovable, right? Then you'll bind yourself up and you won't be freed to love. Whereas if you go with the disposition, I'm here to love, I'm here to pour in, not as an act of, you know, condescension or to make of my partner a kind of charity case. But in the sense that like, I feel like the Lord has touched me interiorly. He's given me something to testify to. He's given me something to share. And I find this person genuinely attractive. And I want to let that person know by way of affirmation, by way of like, you know, I want to touch this person. I want to hold this person. I want to be with this person. And I think that if you communicate that, like your experience of the other as wonderful, and that is, you know, like reflected in your eyes to the other who cannot see it otherwise in certain instances, that's a great gift that you can, you know, bring into the world. And it doesn't mean like you're a missionary of charity or that you're I guess that's a religious order. I should use another term. It just means like you're there to bring love. You're there to testify to the love, and then your needs will be met. But if you lead need, you won't often arrive at love. You'll always ever stay with need. But if you lead love, you'll come to discover that the needs have been met as if by afterthought. So that's another thing. I don't know. Other things from you?
I'm thinking about what you're saying.
That's good.
Yeah. that's a good thing. Yeah. I think too that there, we kind of talked about like being prepared to date a little bit, but I think like the prevalence of like, of sin, particularly with like unchastity or impurity, I think that that being in a relationship doesn't necessarily heal the vices that we have. And I think that if there are vices in our lives that get in the way of being able to love well and give ourselves well, that like that needs time to be healed a bit. So that's kind of taking stock of self, like even asking the question, like, am I in the position in my life right now to actually give myself, to actually love, as you described? We may want that, you know, but there's a difference between being able to do that and wanting it. So that kind of dovetails with like the dating fast kind of thing, or you know, waiting to date. But it's good to take stock of like, where am I in my life, and am I in a position to be able to give? And if we're not, then it's like, fine. That's not like it's not like the end of the world. It's just like, take a little time, you know, work on that. Let the Lord work on you. Let the Lord love you, heal you, strengthen you, so that again, you can love well. Because if we just approach a relationship and dating with like, what am I going to get? Like, how is this going to fulfill whatever? Then it's like, that fades. That doesn't work. That doesn't last.
Yeah. And so, you know, investing in your healing and growth as a human being, this might fall a little bit into gender stereotypes, but here we are, living our best lives. I would say that for women, you might focus on the vice of envy. For men, you might focus on the vice of lust, not in the sense of like, spend all your time thinking about this thing. But if there's things that are going to undermine your relationship, then you want to be aware of them, exercise a certain vigilance, and then submit them to the Lord's healing grace in the sacrament of confession and beyond. And so with women with envy, I think social media has only ramped this up, but envy is classically described as sorrow at the good of another, because it represents a kind of diminishment of my own good, a kind of threat to my own good. So when you scroll through social media, you see like very well curated accounts of very beautiful people saying like, ugh, just woke up, no makeup, you know? And your thoughts about yourself, you know, suffer in turn. But if you're constantly comparing yourself to like internet people, which is to say fake people, then you're never going to be able to engage in the type of relationship in which your goodness is reflected back to you by a flesh and blood person who's right there, whom you can lay hold of. And then with men, again, it's like there's the temptation with lust to make of the other a kind of object, or to make of the other a kind of idol for the satisfaction of need or for the satisfaction of pleasure. But again, it gets divorced from reality in a way that can be, you know, very destructive in a relationship, which can cause the other, you know, great sorrow. So I think that these are things where you ask the Lord to meet you in these places, not that he's going to heal it in 5 seconds, but that he will convict you as to your dependence upon him, so that you continue to like return to the wellspring of mercy, so that you can be on this path, like on this journey. Because if you're on this journey and the other is on this journey, then you can journey together, which is at the end of the day, the point of a dating relationship. Obviously, you know, children too. After marriage, you get it. Okay, so all the proper intermediate steps. So, all right, Father Jacob Bertrand, any final thoughts before we turn to the audience for a couple questions?
No.
Wow. Definitive. All right. As it turns out, I don't have any final thoughts either. So we're going to open it up to you, take a couple of questions, and then we'll wrap. So any questions?
Perfect.
Over here.
Oh, we got a couple of
answers. Okay, perfect. We'll do Luke and then Elizabeth.
All right. Could you talk a little bit about how, just being college students and being young in the spiritual life, how to confront doubt in a way, and kind of avoiding the, I mean, especially in North Dakota, with a bunch of months of lack of identity, how to trust in the Lord and overcome doubt, especially in the kind of vein of what we've been talking about?
Yeah. Doubt in the High Plains. It sounds like a Louis L'Amour novel. Father Jacob Bertrand, I know you like thinking about doubt, talking about doubt.
Do I?
I mean, you suggested it for our last episode distribution.
Oh, I did. That's right.
Yeah. You want to go for it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Do it.
great. Yeah. I guess doubt's a vice in a way. It depends how specifically we're talking about doubt. But for the sake of this conversation, it's easy to lump it in one category. So I can talk about a virtue that counteracts the vice. You know, each of the vices are, or each of the vices are paired with a virtue that that works against them and rights them. So it's like to doubt in some way is I think in ways it's normal, right? It's human. It's to have, because we don't have perfect clarity. We don't see the entirety of the picture all played out before us. So I think on the one hand, it's like, okay, that's going to happen in some ways. We're going to have questions. There are going to be times of our lives when like the Lord feels super present, and there are going to be times when it's like, hello, like anyone there kind of thing. And that's normal. That's the ebb and flow of human life. But the question then of like, how is doubt like countermanded? How do we kind of turn the tide there? Well, first we don't, it's the Lord, it's his grace, but we do so by asking him particularly to grow, I think, in two virtues here that are, well, I'm going to say three. So three virtues that I think are particularly important: faith, hope, and patience. So faith, right, that we might come to believe more, that we might come to know God more, right, and who he is and what it's about and what he's about. Hope in the sense of like trusting that his promises, what he promises, will come true. Like not on our time, not on some sort of agenda, but that he works to bring about what he promises to bring about. But also patience for that to come about, but also patience with respect to ourselves to grow and cooperate in that grace. That takes time. Conversion isn't like a momentary thing. So I think praying, you know, in moments of doubt, we might tend to like back away. It's like, I don't pray as much. I don't, you know, but to lean in is really the important thing. And what I mean by that is like frequenting the sacraments, praying for faith, what did I say? Faith, hope, and patience, these sort of things. And sort of like reinvesting, if that's the case. I think doubt can be a time to recognize again that our Lord uses these opportunities to remind us of our need for him and to lean into that. So those are some initial thoughts on.
Yeah. On the only thing I have to add is don't doubt alone. There's a kind of judgment that people make that if I'm doubting, I am dirty and I cannot be in the presence of the Christian community because I am an insufficient Christian. I said, if you doubt, just bring it to Father Bauck. I mean, like, if you want to bring it. And he'll be like, you said what? You know? And he will judge you severely. Just bring it to Father Bauck or just bring it to one of your friends and then eventually, you know, make your way towards somebody who's not going to argue with you or necessarily try to convince you, but listen to you, hear you, and express a modicum of patience with it because, you know, a lot of times doubts are, they're well-founded because there are things about the faith which are super obscure. But at the end of the day, faith is a choice. You know, St. Augustine says to believe is to think with assent, right? So it's to think with a kind of firmness, a firmness which is lent by the heart. So we have to want to believe at some level. You don't fall out of faith in the way that you fall out of love. You choose out of faith. So that means we have to be constantly choosing into faith. Elizabeth.
So when you were talking about the relationship between the mind and the heart, so as it goes towards university studies, how important / is it necessary to like incorporate theology into your course of study? And like, why is it important to go into higher education?
Yeah. So the question for those of you listening at home is, to what extent is formal study of theology in the university setting important for the cultivation of an intellectual life, of a contemplative life, for your life beyond the university? I think that what I want to stress is just a kind of appreciation of the providence of God. So there aren't accidents, you know, from the divine perspective. So God has you here. And on account of the fact that you are here, there are certain courses that you are required to take. You can treat them like hoops to jump through, but why, right? Because that will incline you in the future to treat all kinds of things like hoops to jump through. And that doesn't mean that you have to perform an act of like mental auto-conviction where you're like, this is actually the best thing. It's like, it doesn't have to be the best thing ever. But at some level, you need to see it as coming forth from the hand of God and for your good. And even if it's difficult, and even if it's the type of thing that you don't want to follow up with subsequently, that's okay. But I think that basic openness to providence is a good first step in appreciating the role that this occupies in your life. So I don't think it's necessary to pursue a formal study of theology beyond what is required of you, but I think it's good to challenge yourself in the life of faith to learn things which you find difficult, because the point of the life of faith isn't 100% comprehension. It's God. And as it turns out, God is not comprehensible, not because he's incomprehensible, but because he's beyond our comprehension. We can get a little bit, but that requires of us that we continue to inquire. Things to add?
Yeah, I think too, the reality that like, what is the, you know, you kind of mentioned, what's the point of study? It's not that we just amass knowledge, but that we come to know a person, and that's God, and that's not exclusive to a study of theology, but you can see in all of the sciences and all of the disciplines where God's hand is at work, and how God leaves what we call like his vestiges, his footprints in creation, and how he uses all of creation and our study of creation and whatever kind of discipline to come to know him from different vantages, from different angles, from different whatever, through the prism of whatever. You know, English is like on point today. But our study of the science of theology, like the science of God, helps to open our minds, our understanding to how it is that God operates in the created world, such that even if we're not like theologians, say like we're an engineering student or like a nursing student, that even in those like hard sciences, we can have an understanding of what it is that God is doing. So it's sort of like an application of a theology into other disciplines, into other fields. But ultimately, again, like we've talked about, it's what we're after. It's him. It's this relationship with him. I think the study of theology, even if it's like a few intro classes, helps to kind of like purify or like clarify how it is that we can chase after, how it is we can know, and what he's about. So.
I still return to the textbook of my introduction to Catholicism class from my freshman year of Steubenville, because it's great, to recommend, because there are images in that book that have stuck with me. And yeah, so the things that you're studying now are like riches, interior riches upon which you can repose for your whole life long. So that just requires of you a little bit of engagement, but it sounds like many of you are sympathetic to that. All right, we have time for maybe one or two more questions. Back. Yeah. So the question is regarding the evangelization of the campus, a campus which is, it sounds like, 65% Catholic, and decidedly so. So that creates a certain vibe. But Father Jacob Bertrand, first thoughts?
Yeah. Whenever my first thought on sort of evangelizing, witnessing to the faith is actually just that, is witnessing to the faith by the life that you live. When I think about like my own life and the sort of the people who have had some real influence on my life, I can't really, you know, like I'm thinking like the few, like handful of people. I can't really come up with like a list of sayings or like things that they told. I remember some things I've said, but not like a list of things that they've told me by which I like then live and structure my life. But it's the example of their life, the witness that they bore, you know, how they were good men, good women after our Lord in various ways. It's that sort of witness. And I'm wholly convinced that it's that witness of goodness, of our pursuit of goodness, is contagious. Like it's infectious. When someone sees somebody who's attempting to live the faith, even if they can't identify, you know, even if it's in a different thing, they're just like, there's just something different, something about, I'm convinced that's infectious. People want that. The good itself is desirable, even if people can't identify. So for me, it's always that. It's less of what we say to people, though that's important. And it's much more of like, what does the totality of our life bear witness to? You know, how do I live my life with the Lord such that that's seen, not on display as like a kind of like voyeuristic thing, but like, how is it that my life bears witness to the gospel? And I think by far and away, that has the biggest impact on people around us. Even if it's like not expressible in the moment, there's like a tangibility to it. So I always recommend that.
Yeah, I suppose I'd work within bounds. So with the recognition that you're not going to convert everybody on your campus, and it's not just because you're not the best evangelizer, you're not the evangelizer that you could potentially be, but like Jesus didn't convert everybody with whom he lived, you know? So there's this kind of strange mystery that even if you give the best case for the gospel or testify in the most attractive way, that people can choose to walk away and they will continue to choose to walk away. Like I think about this, it's in weird places. Driving down the highway sometimes when I like look right and I make eye contact with another driver, I'm like, whoa. But like it brings before me the fact that there are people whizzing down the highway at 75 miles per hour with their own little lives that I will never intersect except in this strange moment. And I'll never preach to them. You know, like I'll never testify to the grace of God. And here you are on a campus with whatever, you know, 1,300 people, and they're going to be people who you just never have a conversation with. And that's not for reasons of lack. That's not to say you should accuse yourself of the fact. It's just to say we're limited. Like, we are limited, and God created us with the knowledge that we were to be limited. And he said, let's see what you can do within your limited bounds. Not let's see if you can push back against your limited bounds and become in turn unlimited, you know, at this height of spiritual transformation. No, he says, I want this to be limited from start to finish. Let's go ahead and play. So I think that you can let your desires, again, give indication of the particular things for which you're made. You know, you're like, okay, there are the most number of people at the wrestling match, so I should go to evangelize at the... That, I wouldn't say that's the best line of thought. If you're like passionate about like chess, let's say, and there's a chess club meeting at the same time as the wrestling match, like nerd out with the chess kids. There might be 8 of them there and 800 at the wrestling match, but like be with your eight people squad. Because I think your desires give indication of the way in which the Lord is forming you to evangelize, to testify to what you love, because you're actually in an environment in which you love. Yeah. All right, last question. Yeah, here we go. Hot take. You don't have to make a holy hour every day. You're like, that's not that hot of a take. All right. So the reason for which I say that is a lot of us have preconceived notions as to what's required of Christians. And then those preconceived notions get ramped up at devout schools. So it's like, I went to Steubenville. There was a lot of pious pressure exerted in Steubenville. It was just kind of in the atmosphere. And so it's like, all right, I guess we're doing all these things because everyone seems to do all these things. And that's not, okay, no, by contrariety, I don't think that we should be hypercritical of everything that everyone does for pious purposes and say that they're all insincere and this is empty and vacuous, and I'm only going to do those genuine things which are, whatever, my own. So there's something good to the pious pressure, but I don't think that we should just be swept along by expectations which we actually haven't interiorized. So I'd say, If you don't enjoy praying, that's okay. I would say most people in this room probably don't enjoy praying when they're honest. And like, don't be discouraged by other people's description of the life of prayer. A lot of times people will say like, I heard the Lord say in prayer. When I hear those words, I think, what does that even mean? Right? I don't know what I still don't know what that means. And here we are 35 years into the adventure, which is human life. I can tell you that, you know, I ate this thing for lunch and I'm digesting it this way while sitting in the chapel, and that makes me feel like this. And sometimes I get the faint indication that maybe I'm supposed to do that, but I'm not entirely sure. But seems like I may as well do this and not another thing. Like, it's often that silly. It's often that humble. So those would be two small things.
Yeah, I think too, like, to keep in mind, like, what's the end of prayer? Yeah, what's the end of it? Like, what's the point? The point is simply to spend time with God. Not to like get answers or that sort of thing. And like, even if there isn't a desire for that, like, I think we ask him to like give the desire, or at least give the ability to pray. Like, even if there isn't a burning desire, but to help, like, the Lord will help you if you ask. And that, again, might not change like emotive responses. That might just like help be a little more disciplined about showing up or that sort of thing. But the end is simply to be with and trust that he's at work despite like not wanting to be there, you know? And again, it might not be a holy hour. It just might be a quick visit to the chapel and that sort of thing. But like, to trust that he's at work, even if it's like, I don't really want to do this. Like, okay, God doesn't need you to want to do something in order to offer you himself. So we ought to take a little consolation in that. Yeah.
Boom. All right. Any final thoughts?
No.
Nice. He's consistent. All right. Well, let's see. Final announcements include that there are stickers and holy cards on that back table pillar altar bench. And you can take them for yourself, for your friends. And again, another big thanks to Father Dominic Bauck for hosting, for having us here at U Mary, which has been a great blessing. Although we've only been here for 22 hours at this point, but we're assuming that the next 22 hours will be equally delightful. Thanks to all you for tuning in. Thanks to those at home for listening to the podcast. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter. Nope, the artist formerly known as Twitter, which is now going by X, Instagram, and TikTok. Like the episode, leave a 5-star review, and subscribe on YouTube or your podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the podcast on Patreon, you can follow the link in the description or show notes. In the same description and or show notes, you will find links for merchandise and also upcoming God-splitting events. Cool things include A Day of Recollection in Lincoln, Nebraska on March 16th. A Day of Recollection in Columbus, Ohio on April 6th. And then some retreats over the summer, details of which will be forthcoming. So, know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on Godsplitting.